Good morning, Your Honors. Anthony Pinelli on behalf of Judy LeVar. This is an appeal by Mrs. LeVar from the denial of relief, which she sought in an effort to have her pension benefits as a surviving spouse adjusted as they were provided by the Steelworkers Pension Trust. I believe, Your Honor, that the law establishes without question that the issue involving a multi-employer fund and the amount of credited service earned by an employee in work is founded on the determination of whether or not there is a collective bargaining agreement, whether or not the collective bargaining agreement requires contributions to be made to the fund in an exact formula from which everyone, including the participant, can determine the amount of benefit which may be claimed. Now, in this case, Mrs. LeVar was not the participant. Her husband, Gary, was. She's a surviving spouse, and she received notice upon Gary's death at age 53 that there was a potential benefit payable to her by virtue of his service in the Steelworkers Trust from 1967, when he began employment, till 2003, when he was deceased while on the job. In inquiring about that benefit, Mrs. LeVar designated her brother-in-law as a person to speak on her behalf, and a series of letters began between Dana LeVar, her brother-in-law, and the fund's attorney, Mr. Richard Hoffman. It was initially Dana LeVar's belief that there is a rule in this fund of 85. If you have significant years of service and age that add up to 85, the benefit is not decreased by the early retirement amount. In other words, if you have 85, you get 100% of the benefit. If you don't have 85, you get 70%, 75%, depending on what age. Mrs. LeVar took this benefit at age 55, when her husband would have been age 55. As such, she received under the plan a 30% reduction in benefit. It was Dana LeVar's belief that his brother had qualified for the rule of 85 based on his years of service, and there should not have been a reduction. Correspondence went back and forth between Dana LeVar and the fund until July of 2004. At that time, Mr. Hoffman wrote a letter relied on by the district court as part of the benefit denial. On July 9th of 2004, Mr. Hoffman told Dana LeVar, "Your brother's widow's argument is with Local Union 17 and not with the trust." Now, what he was referring to was, this was a contract with a company called Indestructo Awnings, owned by the deceased Mr. LeVar's father. He worked there, Gary LeVar did, for his father from 1967 till 2003 in the bargaining unit. And he earned pension credits during that period of time. The 1990 contract was one in a series of contracts that went back to the mid-50s, almost 45 years of history of collective bargaining. In that period of time, every time the contract came to an end of a three-year period, the parties reopened the contract by appropriate legal notice, sat down, and bargained a successor contract. For some reason, in 1993, the contract was not opened, and there is nothing in this record that indicates why. However, the pension fund continued to bill from 1993 to 1996. Indestructo continued to pay. Mr. Gary LeVar continued to remain a union member. He continued to have contiguous health benefits also. Suddenly, on August 31st of 1996, with no explanation, the president of the union called the pension fund and said, "You have to inactivate Indestructo. There's nobody working there." The fund on that day, there is a memo in the case that indicates from a clerical person at the fund, "Based on the phone call today, I have inactivated Indestructo Awning."
Was there a withdrawal penalty from pension fund?
So,
because often that is the case. So that didn't happen here.
No, it did not. Not
so,
to my knowledge.
So what evidence is there of some continuity with regard to the pension in Indestructo?
The evidence of continuity is that from the period when the contract would have expired in 1993 through 1996, the payments were continually made. This particular pension,
After 96.
I'm sorry?
After 96.
After 96, the pension fund stopped billing Indestructo. Indestructo stopped paying the pension fund.
Based on this verbal communication?
Yes. That's what this record reflects. There is nothing other than that memo in this file until November of 1996, when Tommy Thomas, the union president, wrote a letter and said, "I want to confirm there's nobody working at Indestructo Awning." And so at the same time that he was doing that, he said, Mr. Thomas, in a letter to Indestruct Awning, you know, we should get together and bargain a contract. Your last contract expired in 1993, and it didn't because it can't under its own terms. But we should bargain a contract for that. And, oh, by the way, you have another company, and I'd like to get a contract with that company, too. Well, Mr. LeVar Sr. didn't want to bargain about the other company. The parties stopped talking. And at that point, what the record reflects is that there were some charges and other things filed at the EEOC by Gary LeVar attempting to extend his benefits. He was unsuccessful in accomplishing that. And up until the date of his death, up until today, this contract lawfully is in effect. There, it has never been terminated. There's never been a letter. It rolls over every year, absent a notice. It's an evergreen contract, as discussed in Judge Easterbrook's opinion in the case that we cited.
Were the salary and benefits being paid pursuant to the contract? Other benefits and salary?
So the parties behaved
as if the contract was in effect, or they behaved as if it was not in effect?
I believe that the parties, when you say the parties, you're talking about the employer. The employer being indestructible, because the contract is between the employer and the union.
Right.
I don't know what went on. The record doesn't reflect what went on between the employer and the union here, other than the union suddenly in 1996 called up and said, get him out of the fund.
So we don't know if the employees were being paid contract wages.
Judge, I can't answer that question for you, and the trustees of the fund never considered that issue, never asked for any evidence, never had anything before them when they made their decision in this case. So there's nothing in this record that indicates that. My belief from looking at the records is that they paid the union wages so that the workers could go on a job site and not get picketed. But apparently the benefits were not paid to the fund, the contributions. Now, the law provides that if you're working under a contract which requires a contribution to be made, and you get the pension credit. Congress told the Secretary of Labor in 1975, you make rules. And the IRS, you make rules. I appended to my briefs in the district court, and I've appended to this brief, the regulatory letters from the Secretary of Labor that say to pension funds, you may not, by the IRS, you may not be a tax-qualified pension plan if you do not grant service for time, regardless of whether the contributions are paid or not.
So this plan is illegal? Is that your argument?
No. My argument is this plan says, in this plan, it says, this plan will comply with all aspects of the Internal Revenue Service and of ERISA.
But it also defines covered service in a way that's contrary to the letters you just mentioned.
Well, that's a question because it defines covered service both ways, I believe. It defines covered service at one point as working at an employer who is required to make contributions. That's in the pension plan itself, and in the summary plan description, they've added the language for an employer who has actually made the contributions. However, the summary plan description, which I believe the cases say generally controls, says in this case, this is not the real plan. This is just a summary, and if you have any questions about what we really mean, read the real plan.
Right, but the real plan is in Section 212, 1B, says that covered service are those periods of employment with a participating employer. While the participating employer continues to make contributions to the plan.
Yes,
and
it says
and that's
also,
what the district court seized on here, as I understand it.
Well, what the district court said was it doesn't really matter whether there was a contract or not. It seems rational to me. This is the exact language, I believe. It seems rational that if there were no contributions made, you wouldn't get a pension credit. Well, that's not how Sections 2.10 of the plan for participating employer read, because that section says having a collective bargaining contract with the union in which such entity agrees to make contributions to the trust.
Right. The problem clause, though, is this 212, where it talks about covered service being considered covered service only while the participating employer continues to make contributions, which appears to suggest that if there were no contributions being paid or if in this situation the employer was delinquent in payments, that employment service wouldn't be considered covered under the plan. And that was what my question went to. Is that kind of language legal?
Oh, I believe the language is not legal. My belief is it's not legal. My belief is that if a plan has language, what we argued is if a plan has such language, which under the factors for an arbitrary and capricious decision, If it ignores the intent of Congress, then I believe that a judge has the right to say that's not legal. You have to interpret the plan or rewrite the plan, but you have to give a benefit as required by the law. I understand that a judge has to step back in looking at an employee benefit decision and give deference to factual determinations. But I've never seen a case, and I can't find a case, that says that a judge has to give deference to legal decisions or decisions that are made contrary to established case law and regulation and the sex vesting language of ERISA. So, as we argued in the district court, I would say the same thing. I understand there's a conflict in the language between 210, 211, and 212. I believe that conflict should be resolved in favor of the lawful definition of covered service and hour of service and year of service, which is if you work for an employer who is obligated to pay the money. If, in fact, this fund had sued Indestructo, it would be a summary judgment. An appeal would be frivolous under Gerber Truck, under Sheely Trucking, under all of those cases that this court has written. Everything here is within this contract. Pay 8% of the salary, whatever that person made during the year, the contribution rate would not change. Indestructo would have had to pay it. This fund just didn't do anything about that, even after this was brought to its attention.
Can the fund now sue, or has the limitations
period? Well, there is some statute of limitations under the 10 years now for some of the years while this dispute has been going on, but the fund can still bring suit for a number of these years.
Oh, I know there's authority to do that, but I was questioning the statute of limitations here.
Well, a couple of the years have run while this lawsuit's been pending, Your Honor. I see I've used up my opening time. With respect, I'd like to reserve the rest.
That's fine. Mr. Pruitt.
It pleases the Court, Matthew Pruitt for the Steelworkers Pension Trust. I'd like to step back a bit and focus on what we consider to be the heart of the issue on this appeal, which is that to date, plaintiff has never come forward with any theory that would allow additional benefits to be awarded to the plaintiff. As a matter of law, there's only one determination that the plan administrator could have reached. There's only one determination the district court could have reached based on the undisputed facts, the undisputed record that was presented to the administrator, that was presented to the district court, and that now is presented to the Court of Appeals. The key provision here is Section 2.12 of the trust instrument, which defines covered service. And as Judge Goshall, in her opinion, focused on Section 2.12 and determined based on the undisputed record, there is no factual basis for the plaintiff to establish additional covered service under the terms of the plan. Covered service requires that the participating employer continue to make contributions. And there's no conflict between 212, which defines covered service.
How is that legal, counsel, under ERISA and the accrual rules?
Well, what counsel for plaintiff refers to principally in his reply brief on appeal are letters that deal with vesting. He goes back to two letters, from one from 1976 and one from 1978 from the Department of Labor. And if you look at those letters, the 1978 letter specifically limits itself to deal with participation and with vesting, not with accrual. And it excludes accrual and doesn't comment on accrual. This is a case about accrual of benefits.
It separates, by reference, the statutory subsections of ERISA that deal with accrual. At least one of those letters does, doesn't it?
And plaintiff does not cite, nor have we been able to find any case which has ever held that the language in this plan or any similar language is illegal.
Well, this might be the first one. So why don't you tell me why it's legal?
I will also point out to Your Honor that in terms of a challenge to the legality of the plan, that is not a claim that's properly or an issue that's properly before this court. If you look at the complaint that was presented to the district court, the complaint seeks an award of benefits under the terms of the plan. There was not a claim to challenge or strike any provision of this plan as illegal.
Well, if the basis for the denial of the claim is an illegal clause in the plan, then it is fairly, the issue is fairly in the case. I mean, your whole argument is based on this clause of the plan, and it might be illegal.
Well, I wouldn't say that our whole argument is based on this claim of the plan. We also have, as Your Honor knows from the argument of plaintiff, the issue of whether this evergreen clause was somehow sufficient to establish participating employer and covered employee during the periods subsequent to 1996. But to answer your question, Your Honor, the sole basis the plaintiff has to challenge the legality of this provision are these two Department of Labor letters. And again, the Department of Labor, the two letters are from 1976 and 1978, they do not offer any basis, any analysis of the statute to explain why limitation of accrual on this basis would be illegal.
Should we solicit the views of the Department of Labor as to whether this sort of language in an ERISA plan is legal under the participation, vesting, and accrual rules?
The Department of Labor, to our knowledge, has never taken that position in any litigation. We have searched for any opinion on that issue. There's no reason to think that they would take that position, Your Honor. There's no argument based on the language of the statute that's been presented to this court by the plaintiff that this provision is illegal. He relies solely on these Department of Labor letters from the early and mid-1970s. Also, Your Honor, would point out that the case law that the plaintiff relies upon and cited does not address this issue at all. They're cases from a completely different context that deal with the enforcement of plan rights by the pension trust or by the plan, not a claim for benefits by a beneficiary. So there's the plaintiff's appeal here is totally bereft of any case authority at all on this point. Even if this court, however, were on some unknown basis on some statutory argument that has not been raised, if this court were somehow to conclude that somehow this plan provision 2.12 were illegal, the trust is still entitled to prevail on this claim, because in order to have a claim for additional benefits, the plaintiff has to satisfy not only 2.12 but also 2.10 and 2.11, which define who is a participating employer and who is a covered employee. And both of those provisions require that there be a collective bargaining agreement in force that requires the employer to make contributions to the plan.
Well, the argument is that the evergreen clause in the collective bargaining agreement operated to maintain the collective bargaining agreement in place until it was renegotiated or affirmatively terminated, and the letter that you're hanging your hat on is an invitation to renegotiate, not a termination letter.
The letter clearly indicates that the plan is terminated and has been terminated. It does include language regarding an invitation to renegotiate, but that doesn't affect the termination of the plan.
It's not termination language, counsel. The union indicates that on a review of our records, they indicate that there has not been a contract between our parties since 1993, which is not the language of termination. That's a description of the union's understanding of the state of affairs, that the contract lapsed. That understanding was in error. Your client, as the pension trust, has a fiduciary obligation to investigate for the benefit of the beneficiaries and didn't do so.
Your Honor, there was no basis for my client to investigate on this record. This notion that the contract was still in effect is something that has been dreamed up in order to claim additional benefits from Mrs. LeVar.
Language of the CBA.
Respectfully, Your Honor, all of the parties in interest treated the CBA as terminated for 7 years before Mr. LeVar died. Indestructo treated the collective bargaining agreement as terminated. We know from the record that Indestructo never attempted to make any additional payments on behalf of any of its workers to the trust after 1996.
Is Indestructible the union, still in business?
To the best of our knowledge, it is. There is, in the record, correspondence from the Human Resources Director as part of the record that was submitted by plaintiff, and it is a family-owned business. Mrs. LeVar's father-in-law is the owner. Dana LeVar, her brother-in-law, works there. Mr. LeVar, the deceased, worked there. Indestructo treated this CBA as terminated. It made no contributions for 7 years.
Right, the union treated it as... And that might be unfair labor practice under the labor laws.
The question that was presented is whether the collective bargaining agreement was terminated, and we have two parts to that analysis. First is whether under contract law it should be treated as terminated, and then second, whether treating it as terminated would violate ERISA. As a matter of contract law...
Under the labor law, you can't... Ambiguity. A CBA can't be terminated by an ambiguous state of affairs. I mean, it has to be affirmatively terminated, right?
Your Honor, in terms of protecting the rights of all of the parties here, there was an unambiguous termination. We know because Indestructo treated it as terminated. The union treated it as terminated. Mr. LeVar had his union dues repaid to him by check by the union. That happened 7 years before he died. Mr. LeVar never did anything to challenge that. It was his family-owned business.
Well, that's a...
Mr. LeVar was kept in the dark.
That's a laches defense, which I understand you haven't brought.
Your Honor, there would be no basis for us to bring a laches defense in this case. The question is whether we're not asserting contract. The trust is not asserting contract rights under the CBA. And that is a very important distinction for the cases that the plaintiff relies upon. The plaintiff relies upon Gerber Trucking, and there's a real mischief. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, I'm trying to explore here. Hypothetically, this thing is, there's been no contribution since 1996, and the company is still in business. Is that, we'll just take that
yes, sir.
Assumption.
Yes, Your Honor.
If this thing were declared illegal, and however many employees continue to work there, then all of their annual contributions are delinquent.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what would be the exposure for the pension fund if it is determined that all of those, let's just say there are 20 employees, 10, I don't have any idea, what does the fund have to do? Do you have to go back and sue Destructo or whatever it's called? Indestructo, I guess.
That's a really important point, Your Honor, and that's what I was about to address under Gerber Trucking. Gerber Trucking, an in-bank decision of this court, a case actually relied upon by the plaintiff, shows the real mischief that is afoot in this case. If the approach that the plaintiff has taken here is allowed, what will happen is that the trust, which has justifiably, based on the clear conduct of all parties concerned, treated this CBA as terminated and has received no contributions for a period of at least 7 years for any of the Indestructo employees, will now be faced in a situation where its actuarial analysis, its assumptions that on which benefits have been collected and paid, contributions have been collected, benefits paid, all that will be upset. And this case is the reverse image of the concern that motivated the Gerber Trucking in-bank decision.
Well, you have a right to sue Indestructo for the delinquencies, though, right? Subject to the statute of limitations.
Subject to the statute of limitations, subject to their ability to pay those contributions. Again, Your Honor.
Is there an ability to pay defense? I don't think so.
There may be an inability to collect, Your Honor.
Okay, that's a different thing.
And the ability to satisfy the judgment is a significant concern. And this is the mischief that's presented here. What, in effect, the plaintiff is trying to do is to buy an annuity for Mrs. LeVar by, at the last minute, after waiting 7 years, after due notice to everybody affected, that everybody considered this agreement to be terminated, to come forward and say, after Mr. LeVar has died, to come forward and say that we want our benefit. And this is a situation, and that poses a real mischief here because the whole assumption on which a defined benefit plan is based is that all employees will participate and that participation will be continuous over the life of the CBA and the contributions will be made. Here those assumptions have been upset, and allowing Mrs. LeVar to come back and take a benefit at the last minute based on assertions raised only after her husband died is not something that can be allowed and preserved intact, this the structure of this of the trust and the assumptions that a defined benefit plan is built upon.
You know, there's another issue of attorney's fees. It may be not at hand, but there is some question about the attorney's fees, the reason the judge didn't apply them. Now, you had a cross-claim.
Yes, Your Honor. The error that the district court made is in ignoring the presumption in favor of awarding attorney's fees.
Is that line of cases good anymore after the Supreme Court's decision in the Martin case? Are you familiar with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
The presumption that you're referring to is it derives from a line of cases in this circuit construing the ERISA attorney's fees statute, which is permissive in this context.
It is permissive, yes, Your Honor.
Discretionary in the district court. But the Supreme Court's decision in the Martin case disapproves of the use of presumptions in the context of permissive attorney's fees statutes.
Well, Your Honor, the burden still rests on the plaintiff to demonstrate why attorney's fees should not be awarded. And even if this court wants to disregard that presumption.
My question goes to whether the issue of a presumption is even valid anymore after the Supreme Court's decision in Martin.
Your Honor, that's not an argument that the plaintiff raised, and we're not aware of a case that's extended that to this context, but perhaps I'm...
It's just a statutory interpretation principle in the context of statutes that give the district court discretion to award fees.
Well, regardless of whether that presumption is still valid after Martin or not, Your Honor, and I haven't seen a case dealing with that in ERISA, the standard in this circuit still remains one that requires both objective and subjective consideration of attorney's fees. Was it in substantially justified, which is an objective standard, and also was it brought in good faith? The district court relied on an assumption that the plaintiff had an inability to pay and an assumption that the plaintiff had brought the case in good faith, and there was no evidence in the record on ability to pay, and there was no evidence in the record to sustain a finding of good faith. Plaintiff had the obligation to present some evidence if she wanted to claim inability to pay. She hasn't done that below. She hasn't even claimed inability to pay above. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Pennelly, you have 3.5 minutes.
With all due respect to counsel, there's nothing in this record submitted by anyone indicating that there's an actuarial threat to this pension fund by the ruling in this case. There's no evidence in the claim appeal agenda or the correspondence. It's never discussed in the letters by their lawyers. It's not before the district court, and it's really not before you this morning. And that argument completely ignores MEPA, because aside from what the Department of Labor and Congress did in the 1970s with ERISA, MEPA made it necessary for all the contributing employers to the Steelworkers Plan to guarantee these benefits. And if Indestructo can't pay, then that benefit, the amount of contributions and the unfunded liability, gets spread out among the other employers. So that argument, with all due respect, completely ignores Congress's acts in 1984. Additionally, when you talk about Gerber Truck, if you read what Judge Easterbrook wrote in the opinion on rehearing, he said this is how the funds work. That same concept applies both ways. People work under a contract, they earn a benefit, and he specifically says in there, if the employer doesn't pay, they get the benefit. So the law is well settled, but that cuts both ways. There's a beneficiary and there's a paying employer. Aside from that, I think the most compelling reason to look at the legality of the language here is this. The purpose of ERISA was to set up a safety net for people who aren't involved in the negotiation of their contracts. The Supreme Court said in Schneider's, the fund should go out and audit because we don't trust the unions when they do things with benefits. All the law and the purpose and those safeguards were for people like Mrs. LeVar, somebody's wife who doesn't go to a union meeting, who doesn't read the plan documents, who has rights in the plan. When you sign a collective bargaining agreement, I believe, as you said, it must be terminated. It creates rights. It creates rights and obligations by the employer to pay when they pay into a multi-employer fund. There are fiduciary obligations for the fund to take steps to collect the money. And at the end of the day, what the entire system is set up to do is to make sure that the person at the very bottom of the pyramid gets the benefit. Those are her protections. Nothing in this record indicates that Mrs. LeVar is not entitled to them. We respectfully submit that the record reflects there was a valid agreement. It was never terminated. Contributions were owed. Service was earned under the plan, and her benefits should have been adjusted by the district court. I will rely on the briefs for everything else. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.